As the story goes, when a Targaryen is born, the gods toss a coin and the world holds its breath. The gods tossed the coin when the Mother of Dragons was born, and it landed on Crazy. We're going to talk Game of Thrones on this edition of Pop Life.
Digital content on WAER is supported by SRC Incorporated, a not-for-profit research and development company whose goal is to bring a focus of respect, teamwork, and the freedom to innovate to the workplace. Learn more at srcinc.com/WAER.
Game of Thrones Season 8, Episode 5, The Bells, gets us closer to the end. With fire and fury, Daenerys Targaryen spares no one as she unleashes Drogon on a panicked King's Landing. Joining me to dig through the rubble, this week's fellow Game of Thrones geek is Anish Shroff, sports broadcaster at ESPN and former WAER sports director. Welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Run down your bona fides for me. Did you read the books? Have you been watching since the very first season, or are you a binger catcher-upper?
I've been watching since the first season. I have read all the books, including the Fire and Blood and the World of Ice, so I am well-versed in the Song of Ice and Fire and all the mythos.
All right, well, let's get this discussion going, because there's a lot to talk about. First, I want to check in with this week's poll when we measure fan-favorite moments of the entire series to date. The question was, what was the coldest, cold-hearted bastard move of the series? Here are the options. Jaime pushes a young Brandon out of a window. Stannis sacrifices his daughter to the Lord of Light. Tywin takes Tyrion's woman to bed while Tyrion rots in jail. Or Lord Baelish pushes his new bride, Lysa, through the moon door. What do you say?
I think it's Stannis sacrificing his daughter. That was just when people were actually looking at Stannis and saying, you know what? He might not be so bad. We were normalizing him, and then you go basically burn your daughter at the stake because the Red Woman told you so? Come on.
Yeah, that was the overwhelming choice. I believe it got up to over 100 votes. The second closest was Jaime pushing Bran out of the window. There was some debate. People were trying to add folks, characters like Ramsay Bolton to the list. My argument for that is, in order to have a cold heart, you have to first have a heart.
People
like Ramsay, I mean, that's just cruel and sadistic. We never thought he had a heart, and so sadism and torture just doesn't come into the picture. So really wanted to talk about people that we maybe had some hopes for or seemed normal, but really just pulled a cold-hearted bastard move on us. And Stannis was it.
You know what's a good write-in vote, though? It was early on. It was Theon when he was executing, who was it, Sir Roderick? And remember, he had a little trouble getting that blade down.
Yeah.
That was pretty cold-blooded.
Yeah, that was a good one because they raised him. You know, Sir Roderick was his teacher, his mentor. So that was a good one. I should have put that one in there. But here's the context for last night's show. So after failing to negotiate a surrender in last week's episode and losing a dragon for her efforts, Dany and her army take King's Landing, and it's like taking candy from a baby. The show opens up with news of Dany being secluded and depressed after losing her loss of battle, a dragon, and her trusted advisor, Missandei. Tyrion brings her news of betrayal, feeding her paranoia, and setting the mood for episode 5. Let's take a little listen to Dany and Tyrion.
Why do you think Sansa told you? What do you think she hoped to gain?
She trusts me.
Yes. She trusts you. She trusted you to spread secrets that could destroy your own queen. And you did not let her down.
One of the things that fed her paranoia and really set the tone for the entire episode, I want to start the discussion, though, Anish, with just general thoughts, because this episode is getting beat like an old baseball by a huge bat. I mean, the critics are tearing this thing up. So what's your overall impression of this episode as it fits into the entire series?
Well, first of all, for the most part, I liked it. I did not like how they paid off Jamie's character. I think that is probably a universal consensus. But this idea that Danny had this side of her, they've been building that from season one, from the very beginning. You were privy to a sort of God complex that she had. And if you go back to the beginning, in the first season, at the very end, when she burns the witch at the stake, and you go back and you think about it, okay, yeah, she maybe didn't help Khal Drogo, but remember what happened to her people, that the Dothraki did. And she kind of went along with the barbaric nature of the Dothraki in the beginning after being immersed in that culture. So that was normalized for her. When her brother had a pot of gold poured over his head, again, remember her reaction. It was very matter of fact. Yes, he was a bad dude, but he was still her brother. But it was a cold-hearted scene. Remember, she had just eaten a horse heart, right?
Yeah.
And now all of a sudden, you know, this guy wants his golden crown, and Khal Drogo kills him. And it was sort of like, yeah, well, you know, he got. He had to go. You push it forward when she purchases the Unsullied. And remember, she roasts the guy who sells them. You go even further, the way she crucified the masters after freeing the slaves. Again, yes, they were slave owners, but it was this God complex that allowed her to justify a lot of these atrocities along the way. And as a viewer, we sort of allowed her to justify them, and we justified them ourselves. Well, she's doing the right thing. You know, this was somebody who was essentially orphaned as a child. Her whole family was killed. We can kind of understand it. She's taking back what's rightfully hers. And you paper over some of these atrocities she's committing along the way, and there's more. What she did to the Tarleys. Again, these guys had surrendered, but because they wouldn't bend the knee.
Yeah. But now the Tarleys is one of the first moments where we get like real cruelty, because that didn't have to happen. You're right. Some of those others, you know, we allowed to sort of veil them because they were, you know, she was getting some sense of or measure of revenge against people who had wronged her. And you're right. We saw glimpses of that. Since the very beginning, but for the majority, so from episode from the first episode or the first season up until last season, there was more work into building her up to be a hero, don't you think?
Yes and no, but I think we looked at it from the prism of her being the hero and her being the savior. You think of the music that accompanies her, the way she's built up, the Mysa scene at the end of the season where she's literally being carried off, you know, like some kind of messiah. But again, the way she went about achieving power, when she was the underdog, that seemed okay. Hey, I've got to fight. I've got to do whatever it takes, because right now I don't have much. I've got, you know, some loose end Dothraki with me right now. I've got this army of Unsullied, and she was sort of amassing her forces. But then when her dragons came of age, now all of a sudden you have what nobody else has in this world, which is an air force. Mm-hmm. And you have a flying apocalypse. And there were people around her who I thought managed her and did a good job of keeping her grounded, whether it was Jorah or Daario or Missandei or Grey Worm. All these people, and then even the ones who moved into her circle, like Varys and Tyrion. But the loss of those people, the loss of her dragons, has, in my opinion, untethered her from the ground. And so now she's flying above, quite literally and figuratively, on a fire-breathing apocalypse.
Yeah. Now, this
to hold her back. Even think about how she assumed power with the Dothraki. I mean, it was a violent scene where she goes into the hut and burns it down and kills everybody in there. And again, this God complex, like, I'm the chosen one, she has fed into that myth from the very beginning, since emerging from that funeral pyre and hatching those baby dragons.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of been her undoing. So that element has always been there. And then you couple that with her backstory and her family history and who her father was. It's not hard to see her get to this point.
This was not a surprise. So before the show opener even aired, they were recapping last week. And what they threw in at the end of that recap, you heard her brother Viserys say, "You don't want to wake the dragon," right?
Right.
Now, that's from season one. So that's telling me right now, if we're talking about waking the dragon, this chick's about to go crazy. Did you catch that?
Yeah, I did.
So I knew something was coming, but man, did not anticipate all the carnage that we got. There were some big moments in this episode, and we expected to lose some folks. I do want to talk a second about Varys. So we just heard that clip from Dany. She's been told that she has been betrayed. Tyrion tells her that Varys betrayed her, and Varys becomes dragon fodder. One of my issues with the writing is that Varys, known as the Master of Whispers, has been portrayed as someone who has been very cautious with information, mm-hmm. right? He has managed to live, outlive kings and monarchs, rulers, whatever you want to call it, by playing information close to the vest and not sharing it when he didn't think it was wise. But we just get this sort of sloppiness from him in putting that information about John out there and making his intentions or desires known in terms of who he wants on the throne. I just found that to be kind of sloppy writing. What did you think of that?
Yeah, I would agree. What I found with Varys, the one person he clearly trusted and that was established throughout the series was Tyrion. There was certainly a kinship and a friendship there, and there was certainly a trust. They had each other's back. He had helped rescue Tyrion. So for Tyrion to betray that trust, to me, was an element of self-preservation. But the way he did it concerned me because, you know, I think in the beginning of the series, you wondered what Varys' motivations were, and it seemed like he was playing everybody. But the series did a good job of reinforcing the point that this guy was somebody who wasn't born of a noble house. He was a man of the people. And he wanted what was best for the people. He wanted what was best for the masses. He was about the realm, as he said repeatedly. And his counsel was going unheeded. And I think it was a sloppy way to end his storyline.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that was going to be the eventual conclusion, because you could see it when they were all drinking and roasting after the great battle of Winterfell. And he looks at Dany and he gives her that look like, wait a minute. She's kind of isolated. Nobody's really rallying around her. Well, John is the people's champion. He represents what I represent. So that thought had been in his head, and he wants the right person on the throne. So mm-hmm. that was a logical conclusion to his story, especially given what Dany said to him last season. If you betray me again, I'll feed you to my dragons. And she did just that. But I agree with you. I think the way they went about, it almost seemed like they fast-tracked his demise, where you wish it was just built up a little longer and maybe we could have, you know, winded through a labyrinth before we got to that end point.
Yeah, he's played the game masterfully and stumbles at the end. I just kind of find it sloppy. We saw last season where Melisandre and he had a moment at Dragonstone.
Yeah.
And she said, basically, I'm not long for this world and neither are you. And indicated that he had a role to play. And I'm wondering, is that it? Was that the role there? It seemed like there was more to come from him in terms of gameplay than just sort of stumbling and getting killed off in the first 5 minutes of the show.
What I think's important there, go back to the last episode where he does confront Daenerys and he says, listen, you told me not to go behind your back and to give you honest counsel. And he does offer it. And it's good counsel and it's honest counsel. And it's the type of counsel where he's looking out for the greater good. she's sort of on this power hungry streak that we've seen for a long time. I want to be the queen. I want to be the queen. I want to be the queen. It's all about the Iron Throne. It doesn't matter the cost. And he's trying to warn her of the actual costs, both the consequences politically and the cost of human life. And she ignores him. And that was the pivotal moment that caused him to turn and made him question, okay, am I supporting the right person? Is this the type of person that we want ruling, who doesn't have any qualms about slaughtering innocent people? Because we've had this kind of ruler before, and we've seen what the world turns into when we do.
There's consensus from most folks that watched the show last night that the big consensus, the big takeaway for a lot of people was, if John had just broken her off a little piece, if he had just, you know, given in to Danny, had a little sexy night, you know, King's Landing might still be standing. Let's take a little listen to this moment between John and Danny.
What did I say would happen if he told your sister?
I don't want it, and that's what I told him.
She betrayed your trust. She killed Varys as much as I did. This is a victory for her. Now she knows what happens when people hear the truth about you. Far more people in Westeros love you than love me. I don't have love here. I only have fear.
So that clip sets up this thing between John and Danny, where I think she's gonna try to take him out, because she knows that people appreciate and love him more than they will ever love her. What we didn't get in that piece was she tried a little romance first. They went in for a kiss. John was enjoying the kiss until he realized, I'm kissing my auntie. And pulls
right.
away, and that's where she's like, oh, okay, it's like that. So I'm just going to lay everything to waste. That was a really good scene.
I thought so, too, because it gives you the different viewpoints from both characters and their upbringings. The Targaryens, they've married brother and sister, and incest has long been normalized in her culture. So for her... Yeah, this isn't a big deal. You go back to, you know, Aegon the Conqueror comes to Westeros. He had two sister wives who he conquered the world with. So for her, hey, he's my nephew. No big deal.
Mm-hmm.
Why is this getting in the way? And for him, he's raised a Stark. He's raised in the North. And it's kind of like, hey, we had carnal relations before I knew who you were. And, you know, now I've got these conflicted feelings, but I actually know this is wrong and this is not the way I was raised. So you'll be my queen, but I don't think we should continue to push this because it makes me uncomfortable. So, you know, and again, Danny is now at a point where the thirst for power and being so close to it, it's warping her decisions and it's scrambling her mind. And yeah, you get the sense. Yeah, ice and fire. We're about to go to war in this last episode between these two parties. And, you know, right now the reality is John is the only family that she has left. Outside of Grey Worm, there's really nobody else that she feels that she can legitimately trust right now.
Yeah, and that makes her psychologically fragile. You know, that scene just really set up this opposition with John, her closest living relative at this point, who is also her greatest opposition for the throne, her greatest challenge to the throne. So, you know, it's not hard to see that it's going to come down to some sort of battle between those two. Another moment in the program last night, or in this latest episode, who knows when this thing's going to air, but is Jaime Lannister getting captured? Now, that one didn't sit right with me. So, you know, Jaime has from day one, episode one, been an integral part of the storytelling. You just kind of think there's going to be some major role for him in the end. So he leaves Winterfell to go join his sister. We don't get any of that action. We're just told that he's captured. And it just, it just falls flat in terms of storytelling.
I thought they butchered the ending to Jamie's arc. From the very beginning, we sort of saw him as, you know, this sweet-talking, good-looking villain. One guy, you know, having incest with his sister and pushing a little kid out the window and, you know, taking a pike to Ned Stark's calf. Then he loses his arm and he loses part of himself physically, but he finds his soul. And Brienne's a big part of that. And you thought, okay, when he and Brienne start something, that was one of the few relationships on this show you're actually rooting for. Yes, finally, these two. And then for whatever reason, it's like, nah, I got to go back to my crazy sister. And it betrays his whole narrative arc. He, to me, was the tragic hero of this story. And I thought he would get some sort of redemptive goodbye.
Yeah.
One last chance to make things right, whether that's to kill Cersei or, you know, to fight on the side of good or to help restore some kind of order and humanity to a world that doesn't have any of it. And instead, what does he do? He goes back and runs into his sister's arms, you know, his sister who's caused so much pain and so much grief, not just to him, but to everybody around them. And she's been the root cause of the death of their children. So I just didn't understand that being the payoff to his story. I feel like his character was a red herring all along.
Yeah, they really rushed that part of the story. They really rushed him to Cersei, giving us no detail on the road down.
Two episodes ago.
Yeah, I predicted that in order for if we really wanted Cersei to have an impactful death, that it was going to have to be at the hands of Jaime. But they didn't give us that. Now we're going to get to Cersei's death in a minute because now I've backtracked on my initial predictions for that. So let's talk about that in a second. But Jaime's capture leads to a pretty touching moment between he and Tyrion. There's a heartfelt moment. Tyrion is so they did a lot of mirroring not just in this episode, but in the series itself. We had Jaime rescuing Tyrion. Tyrion returning the favor was one example of that. But let's take a little listen to that moment.
If it weren't for you, I never would have survived my childhood. You would have. You were the only one who didn't treat me like a monster. You were all I had.
Now, I found that to be a bit of a tearjerker. I mean, I was choking up at that one. You've come to love Tyrion. Jaime began to develop some redeeming qualities. We began to someone who we hated initially, you know, fell in favor with fans. And you kind of thought that maybe this would be Jaime's moment, but it doesn't turn out that way. One of the other examples of mirroring was Varys and Tyrion. So we had Varys sort of standing by Tyrion at his trial, though he did give him up eventually. And here you had Tyrion standing next to Varys as he was about to get marshmallow toasted by a dragon. But I did think that Jaime would come out of, escaping, that moment to do something grander, something bigger. And it, again, just did not happen.
I thought maybe even him mercy killing Cersei.
Mm-hmm.
Even in those final moments, I thought maybe he just chokes her out or he stabs her because after his fight with Euron, Jaime was going to die anyway. I thought maybe it would be a mercy killing and maybe a different kind of spin on Jaime killing Cersei and from the books, the whole Valonqar prophecy coming true. But it was no, we're just gonna kind of huddle up and take our last breath under falling debris.
Yeah, I do like the fact that you know, it was a real human moment. Now, Tyrion's had plenty of those throughout the series. He started out as a drunken little whatever, and you know, developed into a character that we began to appreciate.
So he's the best character on the show. It's not even close, yeah. In my opinion. Yeah.
That was a really good moment. Let's jump to some action now. So one of the things that last night is getting beaten up for is we had examples of the scorpion arrows of the Lannister army being pretty accurate with these scorpion arrows, and then last night they couldn't hit the broadside of a barn. Now, people were predicting that there would be a bunch of baby dragons in the sky, which I didn't think would happen because Euron in the show promo was looking up with awe in the sky. What ended up happening was Dany used the sun to her advantage. So she put the sun to her back, had those guys looking into the sun, and you can't get a good shot. So while people are beating that up, I think that actually was a pretty good strategy on her part. But once she's out of that position and going around the castle, seems like guys would have had a better shot.
Yeah, there's a great Sun Tzu line, something along the lines of, the victorious win first, then go to war. And those who lose go to war seeking to win, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
That is basically what Dany did the first time. All right, you know what? My Dothraki are in trouble. Let's just send him in. Forget the game plan. It's like, no, you script the first 15 plays for a reason. And this time she learned, and it was okay, like some Belichickian planning. Hey, let's actually have a strategy. Let's have a game plan instead of just going headstrong on a suicide mission and losing the last dragon. Because, again, you had three dragons, so there's really no excuse to blow this thing. Now you're down to one. You know, you had Mikhail, Bird, and Parrish. Now you're just down to Bird. You can still win with just Bird if you figured that out. And so, yeah, it was finally nice to actually see her using a little bit of strategy instead of just a, you know, rush to judgment, if you will.
Yeah, and she learned how to ride the dragon, I think, a little better, too. So she's whipping that thing around like she was a lot more comfortable on his back. The other big moment that everyone's been waiting for, and I want to get your opinion on this, is Clegane Bowl, right? So everyone has been waiting for the Hound and the Mountain to clash it out. Everyone saw it coming, and we ended up with a tie. What did you think of Clegane Bowl?
Disappointing. It was a bad fight scene. It just... I remembered when he walks up and you see the mountain coming down the stairs. I'm watching in my hotel room and I literally yelled out. I go, all right, yeah, Clegane Bowl. This is what we wanted. This is what we've been waiting the entirety for. It was like this past college football season. We knew Bama and Clemson were on a collision course and you think it's going to be this great epic game and it turns out to be a dud. It was the same way. It just wasn't much of a fight. And then – you know, okay, what is dead may never die, right? And he stabs him and he puts a dagger through his head and he still lives because he's dead. And so you're like, all right, this is it just kind of became cartoonish. And then, they go off the ledge into a burning heap. I don't know. I guess I expected more. I thought the fight with Sandor and Brienne was better. I expected more of a better choreographed fight scene. Maybe that's just the action movie guy.
Yeah, I expected a bigger battle with swords, fighting. I would have liked to have seen them on even ground. So you had the mountain higher up on the steps and the Hound, at a disadvantage in terms of that situation. And then it moves from swords immediately into fisting and grabbing and poking and all this stuff. A bit of a plot hole. Now, the entire time that the mountain has been created as this Frankenstein monster, he's been very obedient. But all of a sudden, there's so much hate for his brother inside of him that when he's told to sit, boy, sit, he doesn't sit. You know, he ignores Cersei, ignores Qyburn, and I guess driven by hate, has to get this clash on with his brother. I would like to have seen a victor, right? I would like to have seen the Hound, you know, because of the way he was treated by his brother when he was a little boy, having his face burned, that he would get some satisfaction out of this thing. And that one left me a little empty.
It felt empty just because the buildup had been so immense.
Yeah. Don't know what's going on with the Hero of Winterfell. So while that battle is going on, Arya is, you know, dodging arrows and falling boulders and blocks and all this other stuff. Didn't know really what to make of that. Kind of went into, it seems like, because we weren't privy to any kind of conversation or information, seemed like she was going into this castle without a plan. You know, I'm just here to kill Cersei Lannister. And, you know, it would have been nice to know if we had. Now, if this were George R.R. Martin and this were in the book, we would have an overabundance of detail, right? So we would understand the motivation. We would understand what the plan of attack was, you know, how she was going to do this thing. But the way that they wrote this particular part of the plot was just, again, it was just one-dimensional.
I disagree with you there, Joe. The one thing this show, I think, does a really good job of, and we can get into this a little bit more when we talk about Cersei, is the callbacks. And to me, that was Cat of the Canals, right? It was Arya trying to maneuver her way when the waif was chasing her. It was her being blinded, remember?
Mm-hmm.
Being able to see and trying to figure out her way. I think what we've seen from Arya, she's been one of the best developed characters up until this point. And you're seeing all the things that have contributed to her being at the point she is now, helping her. And so that little bit of humanity that's left that Sandor unlocks, which makes her run and say, okay, no, I do want to survive and I do want to go back to my family. That's also aided by her training. And we see that. She's trying to, you know, help people the way Sandor helped her when she was trying to escape, even though she didn't know it at the time. And a lot of those people didn't know it at the time that she was trying to help them. Because you saw they were resistant at first. And kind of making her way through King's Landing, going through the various streets and canals and alleys, that to me harkened back to, you know, those scenes in Braavos when she's running for her life, training to be a faceless man. So I thought that was kind of an interesting callback. And then the way they capped it with, oh, that white horse, and you know, all we hear about Arya is, what do we say to the God of Death? Not today, and all the stories about the apocalypse, who comes riding in on the white horse. And to me, I thought the imagery of that at the very end was very clear and stark. Okay, she is now the agent of death, and death for the righteous, or I should say death for the wicked. So I actually kind of liked what they did with Arya there.
I agree with you on most of those points. I find the horse to be real Hollywood hokey-ish. I mean, nothing survived Drogon in that city. I mean, that entire city was reduced to rubble. But we got a dirty little white horse just sitting there waiting to be ridden out of town. That went Hollywood. It was a nice cinematic moment.
But it's a callback, Joe. Remember? After the Hound fights Brienne, what does Arya ride? It's a white horse.
Yeah, yeah.
And she takes that white horse, and where does that white horse take her? It takes her to the docks, and she finds that ship which is going to Braavos, which turns her into who she is. So again, I looked at that as a callback as well.
Yeah, I'm not going to fight you on that. I'm going to give you that one. I really enjoyed the cinematic nature of that scene, of her standing among that rubble and all that ash.
That was they kind of used her as well to show the collateral damage of Dany's wrath.
Yeah. Let's get to Cersei. I think everyone, you know, we were sort of trained to think that Cersei was this super evil person that had to die a horrible death. And over the last couple of weeks, now I wrote an op-ed last week, which I was attacked for. It was titled "In Defense of Cersei Lannister," right?
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
we have been you know, we have been sort of trained to think, or we've had this internal dialogue. When I say we, I'm talking about fans, have this internal dialogue that she is just this really evil person. And I push back now because I ask, what makes her evil? What has she done, you know, that has been worse than, say, what Danny's done, worse than what the Mad King has done, worse than what her own son has done? Most of what Cersei has done has been in protection of her children. The only really truly gruesome thing that she did, and that was a revenge moment, was blowing up the Sept, right? And so because there were some innocent people in there. But when I ask, when I say... And it's an important point that Varys makes when he says men decide who resides or who power resides with. So the people kind of decide who's going to be king or queen ultimately. And what has she done to her people that is so horrible that she couldn't survive and actually maintain the throne? In my opinion, she had just as much a claim to the throne as anyone else, you know, because when you look at historically, when you look at monarchies, you know, you have power as long as you can hold and maintain power. You know, usurpers take thrones all the time. And so, you know, while she holds power, she has a right to defend that throne. So now I question this evil Cersei thing. And I think because people played her out to be so evil that she had to die in a horrible way, that this death for her fell flat because she didn't get the comeuppance that most people thought she should have. The scene actually played well for me because I stopped believing that she was such an evil person now that we've seen what real evil is. Now, what do you think?
So, two parts to that. One, I think the way we judge evil on this show is from the prism of power. When Dany was doing some of these things, and like we talked about earlier, she was the underdog, it felt rational. It felt like something you can justify. When she's got grown dragons, and now she holds the power, and she's acting in the same way, it feels different, right? So Cersei has always been in this position of power. And so when we look at her actions, and we look at the lack of mercy, and what she had done to... Missandei, and you know, the way she treated Sansa, and she was getting ready to poison Tommen when she thought Blackwater Bay would be overrun and the Baratheon army and Stannis would take over. You know, she had these moments where you're like, okay, it's evil because you're in a position of power and you are in a position to do good. Whereas when Dany was committing acts, again, where if she was in power and she committed these same acts, we would have said she's evil. But it seemed like she was fighting against something bigger. Does that make sense?
No, it makes sense. But I still contend that the things that Cersei did was not out of the norm for many monarchies that we are familiar with in our own history. You know,
there was a break when she lost her children, and it was before she felt she had already lost Tommen before Tommen, you know, jumped out of a window. So when she had lost Joffrey and Myrcella, and her relationship with Jaime started to fracture, I do think there was a break. And whatever was holding her and whatever was tethering her to that last shred of humanity was at that point evaporating. And now she kind of gave in to her worst angels. And I thought we saw that through the course of the last few seasons, where there was a ruthlessness in the way, you know, there was this thirst for revenge, like you said, and it was at all costs, and we're going to destroy our enemies. And, you know, protecting her clan always seemed to be, you know, at the forefront. But in the same way, you know, protecting her family was her justification in a lot of ways to do some of these heinous things. Now, I'll say this, like her death, I actually liked it, and it fits in with the trope of the show. I wondered too, I said, is Arya going to kill her? How is she going to die? What's going to happen? Think of all the significant deaths, or many of the significant deaths. There's a foreshadowing to almost all of them. In the very first episode, what does Ned Stark do? He executes somebody who ran from the Night's Watch, that guy was telling the truth that he saw White Walkers, and Ned cuts off his head. Ned is essentially executed for what? Telling the truth about what John Arryn knew about the Lannister children, the Baratheon children really being Jaime and Cersei's offspring. Roose Bolton stabs Robb at the Red Wedding. He dies the same way when his own son puts a knife through his heart. Look at Sandor Clegane, face burnt by fire. That's how he ends up dying in a fiery pit with his brother. Jaime pushes Bran out the window, turns Bran into a cripple. Then in the following season, Jaime is turned into a cripple. Littlefinger dies with the same dagger that he tried to give to an assassin to kill Bran. Cersei blows up all these innocent people inside a Sept of Baelor, and they're blown up by what? Fire and falling debris. Cersei dies. How? By fire and falling debris. So I thought there was a little poetry there. My beef there, I felt she should have died alone.
Yeah. Well, she didn't. So she went out the same way she came into the world with her twin brother, Jaime. Let's take a little bit, let's take a listen to a little bit of that scene.
I want our baby to live. Don't let me die, Jake. Please don't let me die. Please don't let me die. I don't want to die.
Just look at me. Look at me.
Not like this. Not like this. Not like
look,
this.
Look me in the eye. Don't look away. Don't look. Look at me. Just look at me. Nothing else matters.
You know, they have been painting, or not. I think they have been doing a good job with Cersei. We are the victims, or at least I've been the victim of my own internal dialogue about who Cersei is. This moment, you know, to me shows that she is not the monster that we thought we would be facing. So we kind of thought that there were two monsters here, the Night King and Cersei Lannister. And here it is. The wool was pulled over our eyes. It's now being lifted. The real monster is going to be Daenerys Targaryen. That moment to me showed how human Cersei was. And we've heard it all along too. The brother that she hated, Tyrion, repeatedly would say, I know you're not a monster. You know, I know you care about your children. So, you know, the moment was that her death was, I think, fitting to the way that I've come to accept, you know, who she was and her role in all of this. You're right. I think I wish Jaime had survived to play a more important role in the season finale. But you know, this one didn't sit too bad with me, and I'm ashamed to say that I feel sorry for Cersei Lannister.
I don't feel sorry for her, but again, the way that they handled her death, I had no issue with what the writers did.
Yeah,
what I've learned from this show that being in power, there are almost necessary evils and necessary monstrosities that you have to enact. And you've kind of seen that. And when Jon Snow says he doesn't want it, you can sort of understand why. I mean, you have to sometimes do things that go against your character, that go against your morals and your code. And what the show is showing us, going against a lot of fantasy tropes, is, you know, somebody like Ned Stark, who stands up for what's right, and other characters who do the right thing, that's not always rewarded. And being ruthless and being unmerciful and things like that, you know, that's the thing that allows you sometimes to climb the ladder when you look at somebody like a Littlefinger or a Cersei, and now, you know, Dany is transforming into the Mad Queen.
Yeah. Look, let's jump, before you get out of here, let's jump into some big questions, some of the plot problems, and maybe some story inconsistencies. One thing I didn't understand in terms of the writing was Cersei leading Euron to believe that the child in her belly was his? Was it simply to get him to fight hard? I just that seemed like a wasted ink to me.
Yeah, and if her due date was any indication, then Euron probably would have figured it out at some point, right? I
mean, yeah.
Unless Euron is really, really bad at math and never took a sex ed class. I honestly didn't care for Euron's character all that much. In the books, there is more depth and breadth to him. He just seems cartoonish in a show that doesn't really have flat characters.
Yeah.
So, you know, him kind of being the last, you know, outside big bad, whatever you want to call it, I was just kind of like, eh. You know, I mean, I was sort of hoping they would kill him off in the first couple of episodes of the season so we didn't have to really deal with him. I just thought it was a weak character, probably one of the weaker ones on the show. You know, and we've had other villains like Ramsay and Littlefinger and Bruce Bolton. And, yeah, I just thought it was a weak.
It was a throwaway. I mean, so you survive your ship getting burned by dragons. You swim ashore. And the first thing you want to do is fight Jaime Lannister? I mean, who is, you know, sort of on your side, on your team's side. It that just did not play well with me. One question I have, and I'm sure they are, but is Jaime and Cersei, are they really dead? You know, this show has been pretty good at showing you when someone is actually dead. We didn't see any hands hanging out of the rubble, no feet sticking out of the stone, no blood dripping from rock. Is it possible they found some little crevice that they crawled into before things fell? Is there? I think not, because I think the die is cast in what's going to happen in the next episode, and I don't think that they have a part to play.
One thing I've learned from a lot of HBO shows, right? The big episode is usually the penultimate episode of the season, where that's where the carnage happens, and the last episode, and even with Game of Thrones, we've seen, right? Ned Stark loses his head in the, you know, eighth or ninth episode of the season. Most of the seasons, the big action takes place before the season finale, in this case, the series finale, and then the last episode, you're left to pick up the pieces and put what's left together. I didn't think it was as cut and dry as a lot of people made it out to be, but everything I read made it seem that they are indeed dead. Remember, they were looking for that last passage. Does the falling debris and does the falling rocks maybe open that up and give them an escape path? Part of me hopes that it is the case, because I think, you know, you could potentially put a better bow on that Cersei Jaime story. But if I was a betting man, I think we've seen the last of them.
Yeah. You know, I'm just wondering about the pregnancy. You know, it just, it doesn't make any sense for it to go out like this and not have that pregnancy mean something. So maybe they're sailing off in that little dinghy to Braavos. I don't know, but it'll be interesting to see what they do with that. Again, there was no proof of death, so they could be on the move. Getting back to Cersei, one of the things that I find as a bit of a plot hole in the character development, at least, is Cersei has been one of the more intelligent women and people in general in this universe. And she's shown some ability to be strategic. And she's learned from her father and her brother about war and battles. I just don't understand why she is standing at the top of that tower with her hands in her pockets, not knowing what to do. You know, that was a big letdown for me. I thought there would be a battle. So Dany comes in with this dragon and takes this city like taking candy from a baby, with no real fight, no real direction from Cersei, other than to just put some people on a wall and hope it holds. What I just didn't get that in terms of who her character, who I think her character is. She's a very bright woman. A very capable, I think, leader, has shown, again, some strategic, exhibited some strategic behavior in the past. To have her just stand there staring out, I didn't get it.
One thing the show has done, and the books too, it's not so much winning the war. It's what do you do afterwards? How do you rule? How do you rule effectively? And I think Cersei looked at that, okay, if you're coming for me and you're coming for my power, are you really going to burn this entire place down and be the Queen of Ashes? Are you really going to incinerate innocent people and then expect them to bow to you and do your bidding? And it was, I'm calling your bluff. Are you willing to do what I did? Are you willing to blow up the Sept of Baelor? And Dany took it one step further. I'm going to raise this entire city, take everybody in it down. And I don't think Cersei expected that from her. I think she knew her brother. Hey, if Tyrion's advising her, there's no way she's going to go through with this. And she did. And that's what's going to be interesting about season 10. Now that you've done this, and now that everybody has seen you do this, both your allies, your enemies, and the innocents involved, how are you going to pick up the pieces and expect these people to love you and expect these people to treat you as the ruler?
Yeah. Big prediction from you for the final episode.
Part of me wants to be surprised, but I think you go back to the original title of the saga, A Song of Ice and Fire. And to me, the key word there is and. Is there some kind of union here, or does it end up being ice versus fire? I go back to one line after yesterday's episode that stuck with me from a few seasons ago, and it was when Dany, after she had burned down the Dothraki hut and she had amassed the Dothraki army and she cheers them on in Dothraki and fires them up. We're going to do things that have never been done. And she's sitting on Drogon. Remember what Dario says to her? He said, Daenerys Targaryen, you're a conqueror. And that line always stuck with me. She's not a ruler. She's never been a ruler. She hasn't been politically savvy, and she hasn't always gone along with her advisors. And when she has, it's often been begrudgingly. So now that you've won, what is it that you're going to do? Are you going to strike fear in everybody's heart and say, I'll do to King's Landing, or I'll do to your city what I did to King's Landing with my dragon if you don't bend the knee? To me, the bittersweet ending here is she's won, but at what cost? She's got nothing left outside of really Drogon. She has alienated Jon. She has alienated the Starks. Grey Worm, her most trusted lieutenant, has now lost the woman he loved. She's lost Jorah, and she's lost countless others around her. She's lost Varys now. Tyrion seems to be done with it after witnessing the atrocities. So do you win? But, if you win and you sit on a throne and you live a miserable existence going forward and you can never get close to anybody, have you really won? And to me, I think we're going to look at victory at the end of this as not so much who gets the Iron Throne, but who's leaving this with a shred or a chance at happiness.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's going to be too many characters that find that, but I do think it's something that Jon Snow knows, because those scenes early with Ygritte, there was a happiness about Jon Snow, and what did he have? He had nothing. He was in a wildling camp living, this sort of lawless life, but free of everything and free of the trappings and the horrors of the real world. I can see why Jon doesn't want that power.
And I don't think he's going to end up being the reluctant king. I don't think he's worthy of ruling. I think he is. I think he is such a he is such a do-gooder that you can't always do good when you are ruling a kingdom. He is too just, I don't think they set him up to win this thing. And I don't think, so it's either going to be, they're going to end this thing in a shocker with Daenerys being the mad queen and ruling the kingdom, something she's driven for from the very first season, or it goes to someone else, not named Jon.
I have a couple of theories. One, I think we're going to find out in the final episode, Daenerys is pregnant with Jon's baby. That is a prediction, because I think you need a way to sort of leave a little bit of hope as to, hey, what's next? But for those that haven't read the books, Jon is also very much his father's son. And I should say father's apostrophe.
That's Rhaegar. His uncle.
And John, right. Rhaegar and Ned. You know, Ned was raised him as this noble, you know, do the right thing, you know, set the right example. And, you know, you think of Rhaegar, who was, you know, supposed to be the prince that was promised, and he was the one that people loved. And he died, but what did he die doing? He chose love. He gave up everything for love. So maybe he sees this greater truth. And maybe that's something that John sees. So I wonder if they bring those stories together. And, you know, maybe Danny finds a shred of humanity. You know, my questions are, what do we do with Sansa? What do we do with Bran?
You're a romantic. So you're still holding out for, I'm telling you, Daenerys Targaryen is a sociopath, right? She is. So they don't, she cannot be left on that throne. There is like zero hope for her. There is like no redemption there. I think
she can't rule. If she's the one who sits on the throne, it's going to be impossible for her to rule because the people don't respect her.
No, she saw that in Marine, and she's going to see it here.
Yeah, like you were the liberator in Slaver's Bay, and then things went to pieces. And what did you do? You skipped town and you told your boy toy, go take care of this.
Yeah. So I think what's going to happen is she's going to kill Jon. And Arya is going to get revenge. Because so we had Melisandre tell Arya, you know, I see these eyes. I see blue eyes, I see brown eyes, and I see green eyes. And we all thought the green eyes belonged to Cersei Lannister.
Well, what's Arya been saying too? I'm gonna kill the queen.
Yeah.
Right?
So I think Daenerys is going to off Jon because now all this paranoia has set in. Arya is going to take her revenge, and Gendry is going to become the king. No, I'm serious. He is because again, you go back to what Varys said: men decide where power resides. So we don't have to do this lineage thing, though he is the son, the bastard son of Robert Baratheon. I don't think Sansa is going to, you know, I don't think the people will see her as the rightful heir to the throne. So I think it's going to be Gendry. I do. I bet, and I haven't looked at the Vegas odds since this episode aired, but I bet you his odds have dramatically shot up.
I think Sansa will rule a free and independent North. I look at it as I don't think there's going to be anybody that sits on the Iron Throne. I think you'll see sovereign kingdoms return. And in some ways, we'll be back where we started, and maybe it's the child of Fire and Ice, maybe it's the child of John and Danny, who is built up as, you know, somebody that can bring balance, if you will. But I can see John maybe even never knowing that Danny has his child. I don't know what John does from here. You know, I know he dies again.
At the end
or not, but my thing is, what, like, to me, Bran. I feel like Bran has been a letdown. Like, I want to know how they pay off his story because he has been a letdown. He goes on this journey, three-eyed raven, all this stuff. He's bait for the Night King, basically checks out for the whole battle. We don't see him in the last episode. Like, what's his end game? Is he just going to be the three-eyed raven, or is he going to help?
Yeah, he's a tool. He was a tool, and he's been used, and that tool is now set on the shelf. I think he has no other purpose.
So you feel his only purpose was to inform everybody who John really was?
To inform who John was and to give some culmination to the Night King.
Yeah, I feel like there's something more. With all that knowledge and all that power, there's got to be something else with Bran.
We'll see. We'll see. We're going to leave it right there, though. Anish, ESPN. Thank you for geeking out with us on this episode of Pop Life, my friend.
Always, my friend. See you, Jeff.
Thank you, sir. I want to say thanks to my producer, Kevin Kloss, who's not feeling better, would have joined us on this episode, but he'll heal up and join us for the next episode. Pop Life is a production of WAER Syracuse Public Media. Be sure to subscribe for future episodes. We're going to be back next week with the final episode. We'll have a studio full of folks, and we're going to get into it. We're going to find out what you think about it, what we think about it, and what the world thinks about what has been an amazing, amazing show. There was no doubt that after a light death toll in episode 4 that we'd see heavy casualties in the next to the last show. So we're going to say goodbye to some memorable characters, including Qyburn, the Clegane brothers, the Master of Whispers, Lord Varys, and the twins, Jaime and Cersei Lannister. I'm Joe Lee.
My concern is that the faith does not adhere to the same standards of proof as the crown. I hope you'll excuse me for saying it, but belief is so often the death of reason.
I'm the one who's going to build the Iron Fleet, because I'm the one who knows how to use it. I've been all over the world. I've seen more of it than all of you combined.
Remember me? Yeah, you do. What do they do to you? Doesn't matter. That's not how it ends for you, brother. You know who's coming for you. You've always known.
If you let me live, I will serve you well. I will dedicate myself to seeing you on the Iron Throne because I choose you.
I would have murdered every man, woman, and child in Riverrun for Cersei. She's hateful, and so am I.
When you play the Game of Thrones, you win or you die. There is no middle ground.